everyone, and welcome to the 226th episode of The Atlas Society Asks. I'm Jag. I'm the CEO of The Atlas Society. I'm very excited to speak to Otto Penzler, regarded as, I would say, the world's most foremost authority on crime, mystery, and suspense fiction. He is the owner of the world-famous Mysterious Bookshop in Tribeca, the oldest mystery specialist bookstore in America, and the winner of two Edgar Awards for Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection and The Lineup. Otto, thanks for joining us.
It's my joy, Jack. Thank you for having me.
So a lot of the young people we serve at the Atlas Society experience a kind of angst in trying to figure out what kind of career to pursue. And I always tell them, find a way to make money doing what you love. Was that the case with you? Did you grow up loving mysteries?
I did not. I was not a mystery reader as a kid. I read science fiction. I read the classics, and I read nonfiction. It's only after I was an English major at the University of Michigan, and when I came home, I wanted to keep reading, but I didn't want to keep hurting my head. And so instead of reading James Joyce and, people that are a challenge, I decided to start reading mysteries and fell in love with the genre very quickly.
Were there any other influences that drew you into the mystery and publishing, writing and bookselling?
Well, yeah, sure. Over the course of a lifetime, there are many influences, but my two goals in life were to write the great American novel and to be the center fielder for the New York Yankees. I failed badly at both, and so I combined them to become a sports writer, which I did for some years. And the whole mystery career was kind of an accident. I was reading and I was collecting first editions of mystery fiction, and that led to many, many other things. A publisher came and asked me to co-write a book called The Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection. And once you write an encyclopedia, you're regarded as an expert for sure, which is what happened. And then from there, I met a lot of writers. I met people in the publishing community, and the community, it's important to remember, is the community.
So we're already seeing some comments sliding in to the direct messages here and in the different comment streams. I'm happy to see that among some of our regulars to this podcast, you've already established a fan base. Now, before you and I were chatting, before we went live, you mentioned how you had early on discovered Ayn Rand and her fiction. So maybe tell us a bit about that story and any impressions that you took away from reading her and then later subscribing to her newsletter.
Yeah, I discovered a book because I was reading science fiction, remember? Somebody recommended Anthem, and which I read because it's futuristic. And I was stunned by the simplicity of the quest in that book, which I hadn't recognized. I hadn't realized it. I wasn't really mature enough the first time I read it, so I didn't. I was stunned by the result, by the end. But that was my first interaction with her, and then later when I got older. And as an older teenager, so I'm going to say 16 or 17 or so, I discovered The Fountainhead and immediately went for Atlas Shrugged, both of which I read more than once.
And any parallels that you see or ways? I mean, people used to say of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged that it was a prophecy, and she would say it's not a prophecy of man's unavoidable destruction, but a testament to man's power to avoid it if he chooses to change course. And a lot of people see parallels today, broken supply chains and boarded up book fronts and mounting disillusionment and despair.
You know, it's so easy to, in retrospect, start to say that, oh, this predicted this, and currently this reflects what happened at another time. I'm not sure that's entirely true. There are a lot of great things going on in the world, and it's not like, you know, it's all doom and gloom, and it's not all destruction. I worry for us. I worry for America, but I don't read it that way. I read Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead as very optimistic books, and I still think of them as optimistic books.
Well,
not books predicting, the end of the world.
Right. Well, we're not going to put any spoilers out there, but I do think that there is this optimistic aspect of it, and that we have these atlases among us, right? And if we treat them with justice, and rather than making them objects of envy, the hatred of the good for being good, then we can all be uplifted by the great gifts that they have to offer us. So speaking of Atlas Shrugged, Rand referred to it as a mystery novel, quote, not about the murder of a man's body, but about the murder and rebirth of man's spirit. Would you say that it's partially fair to include it in the mystery genre, at least from the perspective of the disappearing characters?
No. A mystery, look, everything in life is a mystery. You know, you could say, well, Romeo and Juliet was a mystery. Were they going to get together? Is that a suspense novel, a suspense play? Is there a mystery? Like, why did they fall in love? What drove them to this? You can categorize almost anything in the world as a mystery. Before we came on, I told you that I edited a series of books called The Best Mystery Stories of the Year. And I define mystery in the introduction to every one of those books, so that, you know, we're not talking about mysticism or religion, many of which are mysteries, parts of which are mystery. To me, the definition that I use, and I think is a fair one, although it's a very generous one, I describe it as any book in which a crime or the threat of a crime is integral to the plot or the theme.
So I guess another question I would have would be, why do people read mysteries? What's the itch, or psychologically or emotionally, that mysteries scratch for us as opposed to other genres?
I have two responses to that. I think the most common one that several other people have used is that they're adult fairy tales. And, when we're very young, and fairy tales tend to be a battle between good and evil. And in fairy tales, good almost always wins. And for a very long time in detective fiction, especially, the good triumphed over evil. You know, we had a social fabric and it was destroyed by somebody, and the good guy came along, solved the crime, and restored that fabric. So the good triumphed, evil was defeated. My second thought for this, and I'm not sure that anybody ever agreed with me or disagreed with me if they ever knew about it, is I think that the mystery novel, and by the mystery novel, I'm narrowing it a little bit to say the detective novel, because there are so many elements, so many subgenres of the literary form of mystery fiction. In the detective novel, I believe that it's a conservative genre. And I don't mean it's in a political sense. I mean it in the sense that we, as a society, we have expectations. If you go to a restaurant and you order a steak and you get a lobster, it may be a great lobster meal, but it's not what you wanted. You expect to get a steak. And in life, we expect certain things to exist. So we expect to get home safely. We expect to turn on a switch and the lights will come on. All of the things that we normally expect. Well, a murder is not something that we expect. And so what we want is for the social fabric that's been torn by that act that of lack of civilization, as it were. We want the detective to come, and we root for the detective to come, catch the bad guy, and put him away, or whatever he chooses to do with him, and restore that social fabric, which is a conservative notion, whereas science fiction is anarchic. You know, we don't have expectations because we don't deal with Klingons.
So one of our regulars, Kingfisher21 on YouTube, is saying that The Long Goodbye by Raymond Chandler was his first introduction to crime novels. I'm wondering, I'm sure you could go on and on this question, but what are some of the greatest all-time mystery fiction writers, crime fiction writers, that you would say you shouldn't go through life without at least reading them once?
Well, I'm a cliche, because when I decided that I was going to start reading mysteries to see what they were like, to see if I liked them, I picked up the complete Sherlock Holmes, which almost everybody did. Women, when they were girls, read Nancy Drew. Boys read The Hardy Boys. But almost everybody read Sherlock Holmes. And I hadn't gotten to it yet. But when I did, I knew that I had found something really special. So I love the mystery form. And I started reading the very popular writers of the time, people like Agatha Christie and Ellery Queen, John Dixon Carr. And the puzzle element was intriguing to me. I really enjoyed trying to figure out what it was. I almost never could. To this day, having read 5 million mysteries, I'm still constantly fooled. I always think it's the most obvious person. I never think it's the least obvious person. And it always is the least obvious person. So I enjoyed that puzzle, but it was when, and I see that one of your guests talked about having really discovered Raymond Chandler. When I discovered Raymond Chandler is when I discovered that this is actually serious literature. It's not just about a puzzle. It's not as just trying to solve a mystery. The use of simile, metaphor in Chandler and in Hammett and many other of the best writers in this form, this literary form, made me recognize what a great a kind of literature this was and how enduring. And the great examples of how enduring it can be is if you take a look at the Pulitzer Prize winners from the 1920s or 30s. You have T.S. Stribling for The Forge, or Caroline Miller for Lamb in His Bosom. Nobody reads them anymore. Nobody even knows their names anymore. But The Maltese Falcon, or for Hammett, or The Big Sleep and others for Chandler, they've been in print every single day, every year, since they were written in the 20s and 30s and 40s in Chandler's case. So there's a great enduring. They have a life and an energy and a universality that the best literature has.
So on that score, what are the snobbery of some literary types when it comes to the mystery genre, in terms of bias that mystery can't be great literature? Where does that come from? Do people feel like, you know, it needs to be more challenging, or it needs to be kind of like Joyce, needs to be obtuse? And has that kind of persisted, or do you think that's waned through time?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm glad you asked the question, because it's a question I like answering. When I opened my bookshop, when the Mysterious Bookshop opened, we this year celebrated our 45th anniversary. When that opened in New York, it was very common for people to come in and say, well, you know, I don't really read this. I'm buying this for my uncle or my son or whoever. They read this stuff. And I said, really, you don't read mystery fiction? No, of course I don't. So you've never read Dickens, half of whose books involve murders, kidnappings, theft, and so on. You've never read Dostoevsky, never read Crime and Punishment. Say, oh, well, those are different. No, they're not. They're good. They're better than most. That doesn't mean they're different. And that was true for the early years. I'm going to say 5 to 10 years, maybe longer. But as time has gone by, we've learned that really it's a lot of intellectuals who read mystery fiction. T.S. Eliot, for example, and W.H. Auden were huge mystery fans and wrote about mysteries on a regular basis. And so I don't get too much of that anymore. In addition to which, you have people like the former poet laureate of England, who wrote as Nicholas Blake, and Michael Innes, who is a professor in England, I think at Oxford, but I could be mistaken, who is a mystery writer, as Nicholas Blake was, but also a great champion of mystery fiction. So I think that has largely stopped that looking down your nose at the mystery genre.
So you talked about the early days of people coming in and kind of brown bagging it with the best new mysteries coming out. So let's just kind of roll it back even further. The Mysterious Bookshop has really become an institution in New York City. Take us back. It started with the Mysterious Press, right?
Yes. Next year, Mysterious Press will, pardon me, celebrate its 50th anniversary. I had become, because I wrote this book called The Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection, I got to know quite a lot of writers, because I wrote to every living writer, and if they were not living anymore, I would find their significant others or children or agents, whatever, and I would send the material to them and say, is this right? Am I missing anything? What should I change if I need to change anything? And as a result of meeting a lot of writers, I became very close friends with the best mystery editor who ever lived, a woman named Joan Kahn, who had her own imprint at Harper. It was a Joan Kahn novel of suspense. And we became good friends. And I started at our lunches, I started complaining about why don't publishers treat mysteries with a little more respect. You know, they had pressed cardboard covers instead of cloth covers, two-color dust jackets instead of full-color dust jackets. They were treating them as if they were trash. And so I think I complained once too often. And Joan said, instead of complaining, why don't you just start your own publishing company? And I said, I don't know how to do that. I've been a sports writer. I don't know how to do that. She said, it's not that hard. Figure it out. I said, I also don't have any money. She said, well, get some. You know, she was just like, let's just do this. And I did. I borrowed money from, or I sold shares in the Mysterious Press to a bunch of friends and my brother, and started publishing on my own. And I thought a good way to do this was to get writers who have a name, who are successful, and publish something by them. Of course, I couldn't compete with the general publishers, but most publishers never wanted to publish short stories. And so I got short story collections from people like Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho and other successful books. Ross MacDonald, the great Ross MacDonald, I got to publish his complete Lou Archer short stories. Cornell Woolrich, the great 20th century Edgar Allan Poe, the master of noir fiction. And that's how I got started publishing those things. And, you know, it was okay in the beginning. I was doing everything from editing, commissioning the books, doing the contracts, hiring the artists to do the dust jackets, proofreading, wrapping the books and taking them to the post office. When I say I did everything, I mean everything, which was fine until I had success and the book started selling. I couldn't keep up. So I wanted to get an apartment in New York in Manhattan. I was living in the Bronx, and so books were being delivered and I was storing them in the basement of my apartment in the Bronx. So I wanted to come to Manhattan because you couldn't call a secretarial service and say, oh, send a girl up to my apartment in the Bronx. So I went to try to find a place in Manhattan with one extra room that I could use as an office, and couldn't afford the rents, and wound up, this is ludicrous for me to say now, wound up buying a building in Manhattan on 56th Street, right behind Carnegie Hall, with a partner. And my life savings was the down payment. And my life savings was $2,000. And it was the summer of 78. The city was bankrupt. People wanted to get out. And the man who owned this building was an elderly and wanted to get rid of it. And so he sold it to us for, as you see, almost nothing. And when we moved in, I looked in the ground floor and the first floor were empty, or could be. And I said, wouldn't it be fun to have a bookshop here? And I didn't know anything about publishing when I started. And I didn't know anything about opening a bookshop when I started. And I made every possible mistake. So here I still am.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be switching to questions in a little bit, but I just wanted to pause to remark on all of the love that is coming across from you, Alan Turner, who's a regular to these podcasts, as he remembers visiting the Mysterious Bookshop back in 1993.
Yeah, I can see that. 93, we were still at 56th Street. We moved 19 years ago. We're down in Tribeca now. It's about three times the size of the store that was at 56th Street. I still call it the new store because
the new store.
I've only been here 19 years.
And then we also have Chris Wilder, who's saying, thanks for coming across on this interview, that he's referring his wife to your bookstore. So Chris, I don't know if you are in New York or city or the greater Manhattan area. I guess, Otto, if someone isn't, you know, physically in the environment of the store, do you have a site where, like, what's the best way for them to buy books from the Mysterious Press?
Yeah, Mysterious Bookshop. Mysterious Press doesn't actually sell books. It sells it through the bookshop. We sell books through the bookshop, but every publisher, obviously,
and you sell them publishers online?
And major publishers. Yeah, of course. We have a website called mysteriousbookshop.com. It's not really creative. And we have customers all around the world. We've been servicing Hong Kong and England, France, Japan, a lot of good customers in Japan. There it is. See, www.mysteriousbookshop.com. Scandinavian countries are they're heavy readers, so we have a lot of customers there. But in every state in the union as well, and we've been shipping books everywhere. If I were just trying to rely on walk-in traffic, we wouldn't be able to pay it. I have five people on staff, and rents in Manhattan, you may have heard, are expensive.
Yes. Definitely. And of course, you know, when we think back over these past 45 years with the changes with Amazon and these mega bookstores, it's been really difficult for independent bookstores to survive. So to what do you owe the longevity of the Mysterious Bookshop?
My own genius. No, I'm kidding.
Why not? Hello, we're objectivists here. You can say that.
It's not entirely true. I also have I've had great staff members over the years, which have been really helpful. Also, I'm stubborn. You know, there was a period where we were losing a lot of money every month. And I recommended to me by my tax accountant. She called him that night and said, I can't take this job. And he said, why don't you get along with Otto? He said, oh, no, I love him. He's wonderful, but he can't possibly make it. He's covering his staff salaries and rent and taxes and Con Ed and, you know, all of that. He's not paying his suppliers. He does not making enough money. He can't make it. And that was largely true for about 8 years. We were losing a lot of money every month. I took a second mortgage. I did more writing. I did more anthologies. I did some speaking, and everything went into the store to keep it alive. My wife was begging me, close the store. We can't afford, we can't pay our mortgage. You know, I said, no, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. And it did. Here we
are. Eventually it did.
And it's actually in black ink now. It's a nice change.
Entrepreneurial creativity and persistence. Persistence, that's the key. So you have worked, as you said, you got to know personally many, many legendary mystery crime authors. Any kind of anecdotes or interactions that stand out that our audience might enjoy?
There are a lot, yes. And I've been very, very blessed to have known most of the major writers, sometimes some very close friends. And James Ellroy, for example, I was best man at his wedding. Elmore Leonard and I became great friends. I appeared as Otto Penzler, SS Sturmbannführer Otto Penzler. I was a major, I guess it was major general for Rommel in Africa, the Africa Corps. So I appeared in his book. Evan Hunter, who is better known perhaps in the mystery world as Ed McBain, and I were great friends for many, many years. The stories. I'm actually writing another little book about stories about the authors that I've known. And what could I tell you? I would only tell you the good stories on the show. The book will have some stories that are not so good. Now I'll tell you one of those anyway. Patricia Highsmith, a very well-known writer, wrote Strange on a Train, Ripley series, brilliant, brilliant writer, whose work I admired very much. And I met her in my bookshop. We were doing a signing for her, and nobody showed up. We had like four people. And we had scheduled her for 2 hours. I'd never met her. I knew nothing about her except her work. And so the people got their book signed. 5 minutes later, it was just Pat and me. And so I'm trying to make conversation with her. I said, oh, you're living in France now. She was born in Texas. And that a lot of people think she's English because the name like Highsmith sounds sort of English, I guess. She was born and raised in Texas. Lived in New York for a while. She was a party girl, like everybody, put it as politely as I know how to, and then moved to France. And I said, so, making conversation, so why did you move to France? Is it the language, the beautiful French language? She said, I don't speak French. Oh, is it the people? The French people, you know, do you particularly like them? I can't stand the bloody frogs. Oh, where do you go from here, right? I've now used 2 minutes of our conversation. That was it. So I said, well, then why do you live there? And she said, well, it's not a bad little village. Huh. And I don't remember where the rest of the conversation went, but it was agony. And it didn't last a full 2 hours, I know that. The only good thing that I ever heard her say, the only thing that she ever liked that she said was, we had 2 hours. She had insulted terribly this very young publicist that was taking her around. And I told her to stay home, that I would take care of her. And so we had two hours between interviews. And I said, would you like to go for a drink? And she said, a beer. I like beer. It's the only positive thing I ever heard her say.
Well, you know, there may be a reason why such unpleasant people choose solitary careers. All right, we've got a lot of great questions here. So I'm going to dip into a few of them. Alan Turner, again, who visited your store back in 93, says, I remember mystery and crime novels and films being all the rage in my youth. Has it become less popular, or are these genres still strong today?
Mystery fiction genre has never gone away. There are various waves of types that are beloved. Now, you have somebody like Anthony Horowitz, this multiple talented writer, Richard Osman, who goes to write number one immediately. obviously John Grisham, Michael Connelly, who always goes to number one on the New York Times list, who is a terrific writer and one of the nicest people in the whole world. In fact, I was at Yankee Stadium watching the World Series with him last night. Lee Child, I don't want to do a commercial here. I don't want this to seem unbecoming, but I've just published a new book by Lee Child, who you probably know has been writing the Jack Reacher series. And he was at the game with Mike Connelly and me on Monday night. So, but the you know, all of those guys, all of those people go to number one on the New York Times list. The genre remains very, very strong. Every third television series, every other television series is a mystery series. Many imported from England, and then many produced here, of course. So yeah, it's strong. It's a very popular niche.
Kingfisher asks, what do you think of writers who have tried to subvert the mystery genre by showing evil defeat the good, either blatantly or by corrupting the good?
Well, you know, there are people in the world who can't stand good. Many of them are criminals. I'm not accusing writers trying to subvert the general notion that we have of mystery fiction of being evil or bad people. I'm not. But they like tearing down rather than building something good. You know, it's very common now to take this point of view of the criminal. It is very uncommon in crime fiction for the criminal to be the major protagonist, to be the protagonist. It was true for Highsmith, but very uncommon in all of crime fiction, whether it was from the 19th century or the 20th. But in the 21st century, it has become more common for the criminals, for us to be more concerned about if their grandmothers hit them when they were 4 years old, to explain why they're antisocial.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is a great question from My Modern Galt. First to the show, asks Otto as an editor, what do you believe is quintessential to mystery fiction, and what do you sometimes see lacking in modern day manuscripts? So yeah, maybe just some examples of, like you said, your eyes are wearing out from reading all of the manuscripts that are part of your job as an editor. What are some of the things where you say, this one, I'm gonna put it in the no pile, and this one, the pile?
Yeah, I can't begin to tell you how many manuscripts, books and manuscripts I've read over the years. They really add up a lot. But, you know, when I'm evaluating a manuscript, it's no different from an editor of literary fiction in what you look for. The puzzle, what makes mystery fiction harder to write than most forms of literature, is you have to have the Greek arc of a beginning, a middle, and an end. You can't just have a slice of life and not worry about tidying it up at the end. But you look for things like, do the characters come alive? Do you care about these people? Are they somebody that you can get to know? Is their dialogue different? I once knew Shel Silverstein. Shel, I was having a very bad time. My wife had left me, and I was very, very sad. And he says, when I go to heaven, I hope I'll see him so I can ask him, remind me of what you said, because he said something that was so thoughtful and so smart. I said, oh my God, I've never heard anybody say something like that before in those words. He said, Otto, that's why they call me a poet. And that's what I look for in a novel. I look for the poetry. I look for the language, the prose, to be something that I've never heard before. I want it to be different. I want to recognize it as something that's above and beyond. So you need characters and you need good dialogue. It helps if you have an interesting background. And obviously you need a story. So those are the elements that I look for. You can't I have long lived in the theory that you really can't teach somebody to be creative. They either are or they're not. You can teach them to be better, but you can't make them creative.
Well, I think there's also a certain almost philosophical and personality aspect to creativity, which requires a certain confidence, a certain, like, I don't give a hoot about what other people think, because to be creative, you need to take risks, right? You need to be willing to do something different. And people who are very dogmatic or who lack confidence or who are overly focused on what other people think of them, I think that constrains them and that makes them less willing to take the kind of risks that creativity requires. All right, another good question here from Lock, Stock, and Barrel asking, where do most of the great mystery writers hail from? Is mystery fiction more of an American fancy, or is it big in Europe too?
That's a very good question, which I want to answer, and I know how to answer that. But I want to go back to for a minute, if I may, if you'll indulge me, to when I met my third wife, my third and last wife. It was at a writer's conference, and they had sent pages to me, which I read on the flight to go out to California to meet with these people and maybe help them become better writers. And so I marked up my pages, and I'd had no idea who the person was. There was just a name attached to it. And this was a very good manuscript, 30 or 40 pages that were excellent. So I'm sitting in this room waiting for my person to come and look at it. And the door opens and this very beautiful blonde young lady looks in and she said, "Hi, I'm Lisa. Please don't make me cry." And I said, "Oh, what are you worried about? No, you really are good. Why would you say that?" Well, it turns out that she had met a person outside who said, "Oh, who are you going to see? Who's your editor?" And she said, "Otto Penzler, because he edited Jane." And don't see him. He's a monster. She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I was at a mystery conference about 5 years ago, and he had read my pages, and he just said, 'Do you paint?'" And I said, "No, I don't paint." And then he said, Do you play a musical instrument?" And I said, "No. Why do you ask?" And he said, "Because you can't write. You have a creative impulse. You want to be a creative person, but you have no ability to write. You can't write a sentence, and nobody can help you." So she kept going. So she burst into tears and left. I thought I was doing her a favor by stopping her wasting her life trying to write books. And so that's why she cried, and that's why she told my future wife that that I was a monster. But to go back to the question, where do most writers come from? Until about roughly 25 years ago, 30 maybe, almost all mystery fiction was written by Americans or British. And the reason is that you could not live in an authoritarian regime, because if you went to the police to get help in the United States or in England, you expected to get some help. But if you went to the police in Russia, Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, many other countries through the years, it's the police who were your enemies. And so you couldn't write detective fiction in the way that we know it, where there is somebody who can help you in a situation where you're threatened or your mother has been murdered or whatever. So most writers were English or American. The French had the most other people, but there were almost no decent books coming from Asia, almost no decent books coming from Russia, or from several European countries. That has changed dramatically. Now translated books are extremely hot. A lot of it was partly because of Stieg Larsson and the Dragon Tattoo series and so on. But there's a lot of good Japanese fiction, good Korean fiction. Italians and Germans are writing, which they'd never done before in any meaningful numbers. So, of course, there are always exceptions to the generalizations that I've just made, but it was English and American for that reason.
Candace Morena asks, after all of the reading, do new mystery novels and manuscripts still surprise you?
Seldom, but I will say it's not that new anymore, but when I read Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, I never saw it coming. I was shocked. It's brilliant. I remember everything about that book. I watched the movie, which doesn't do justice to the book, although it was a good movie. So I can be surprised, but not usually. But I am always surprised to some degree by who did it, because I'm no good at it. I can't figure it out. I'm the most gullible human being on the planet. When I see that this person has every opportunity to kill somebody, they have every motive to kill somebody. And he killed somebody, but they never do. It's always, I'm always surprised at who really did it. And it's always the least likely suspect. And I never think it could be the least likely suspect because A, I like them too much as characters, or they didn't really have an opportunity, or we don't know what their motive was and doesn't seem real to for them to have a motive. So I'm surprised in that way, but surprised in a bigger way, like, oh, this is something I've never read before. That's really hard for me to find these days.
Jackson Sinclair asks, what do you think is the best advice for new writers? Do you think it's learning to take constructive feedback?
You know, I've worked with a lot of editors and over the years, people who I respect, certainly a lot of writers. And William Faulkner said it. Stephen King said it. It's the same thing. Read, 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 read everything. And you can't, if you're not a serious reader, a relentless reader, a joyful reader, you cannot possibly hope to write. If you don't see what's come before you, you have to learn from that and then write, write, write. You can't write a book and think, I'm done. I've written the end. So I've told my story. I have nothing else to do. So I'm done. And if I don't sell that, then I'll quit. Well, you're probably not going to sell it. A lot of very successful writers, people like Elizabeth George, Jonathan Kellerman. Jonathan Kellerman had 10 books before he published one. Elizabeth George, roughly the same. Michael Connelly had a book that he realized wasn't going to be good enough. He said it never got published and it never will. So you have to write over and over, take criticism, this is hard. I've done a lot of writing. I don't write fiction. I don't have the talent for it. But I've written a lot of nonfiction. And when you work really hard on a book and you do the best you can, you write it, you rewrite it, you go back and edit, rewrite some more to get it to be absolutely perfect in every way that you know how to do it. And then somebody comes and tears it apart and tells you all the things that are wrong with it and what you need to do and how you can make it better, how you can save the book and so on. You have to be strong. You have to be willing to understand that it's not personal, that somebody is not deliberately trying to hurt you by telling you your book isn't working. You have to listen to that. So they come in sequence. You have to read first, write a lot after that, and then take criticism after that.
Another question from the best Tom, saying some solutions are unsatisfying and I haven't been able to figure out why. It strikes me that if the detective arrived at a solution through implausible means, it falls flat. Would you agree with that?
It does. I agree with that totally. It is harder and harder to write pure detective fiction, partly because Agatha Christie was so incredibly creative. She used up most of the plots. So everything that is written now is probably a variation on the theme of something that she wrote. I'm exaggerating, of course. But yeah, a lot of detective stories now are solved by somebody ratting out the guilty party, somebody confessing, somebody having made such an egregious error that that the police, even clumsy police, could find that solution, that clue that is going to catch them. It's very, very difficult to find somebody who can put together a compelling narrative with clues that are well concealed but fair, and then come up with a solution explaining all the clues that that protagonist, that detective, used to find the answer, to have done the reasoning, the rationalization of how they would do that. You know, back in the 30s and mostly the 30s, two of the great American writers of that what was called the Golden Age, the years between the two world wars, Ellery Queen and John Dixon Carr. Queen particularly would stop on many of his books, would stop the action, and there would be a page. It's a dear reader, you now have all the clues that you need to solve this crime. Ellery Queen will solve this crime. Now you can, if you think about all the clues that you've been handed. Never worked for me, but I could never figure them out anyway. But they were so ingenious, and they were challenging. They were arrogant enough to say, listen, I've just given you all the clues. Go and you figure it out. So, So nowadays, yeah, somebody confesses and that's how you find out, or somebody, you know, rats somebody else out. That is, cheap.
Well, that kind of reminds me of Ayn Rand, and how she had her play, Night of January 16th, in which after she had that, she had the audience come in and describe and decide what was going to be. So anyway, another question I had was, how has the advance of technology changed your business, changed the mystery crime genre, things like e-reader books or audio books?
Let me get to that. I do want to respond to the January 16th thing. The sound went out when I was listening to you, so I don't know if everybody heard that. But it was basically solved when the audience was asked, I forget if it was raised hands or applause, who was guilty, was this person guilty or not guilty? Rupert Holmes then wrote The Mystery of Edwin Drood, taking Charles Dickens' unfinished novel, and made it a huge success on Broadway, and did the same thing where he would, one of the actors would ask each of the nine people who were suspects, ask the audience which one did it, and whoever got the loudest applause, then that person would sing the song explaining why they did it, which worked for quite a long time, and was a joy for everybody involved in that show, until everybody learned that Cleo Lane was one of the people, and she had the best voice by far. So she was picked as the guilty person every night. Anyway, so sorry to go off track, but I'll go back to the idea of technology, which I will preface by telling you that I am an absolute technological moron. I am so challenged by everything that it's a miracle that I'm on here with you on a computer without messing it up. Fortunately, my staff is younger, and so every time I have a problem with my computer or my cell phone, they come and solve it for me. How has it changed mysteries? I don't know. I suppose, you know, because of ebooks, a lot of people now like reading on a Kindle or a Nook or on their phones, what are they called? Some like a book kind of thing with with electronic stuff on it. I don't have any of that. I do own an ebook publishing company. It has about 2,000 great old books on it, but I still don't read on any device except stuff that I have to, and which I read all day. But I don't read for pleasure on my phone. I don't know how people can do that. Even when my eyes were better, I don't know how you can read on the phone or in on a Kindle. I like to know how far along I am in the book, how much longer there is. Is this going to have a quick ending, or is it going to have is there more stuff coming, some more surprises? You can't tell that on a Kindle. So they're not for me, but, you know, I suppose I'll be getting to it soon because you can make it larger.
There's that. And I have to read at least 2 or 3 books a week to make sure that I'm keeping up with my guests and keeping up with the different books that we're publishing. So I'm very grateful for Audible. And there's a whole new audience out there. So, you know, if writers aren't taking advantage of that, you know, they're trying to make a living as well, and they're leaving money on the table.
We sell with the books that we publish, we sell to Highbridge, and they produce really first-rate audios. And I think I'm probably, you know, again, I don't want to keep dwelling on my eyesight, but as it's deteriorated badly, I'm going to be learning to read my books, so to speak, as audios, and I'm fine with that.
Now, you are someone who's worked to preserve and
people are reading.
Yeah, as long as they're reading, one way or the other. I do think that when you are reading as opposed to listening, it can be a more vivid experience because you actually are really working to fill in the voices and fill in, the ambiance and all of that. And so it can be a more vivid. In the best of worlds, I like to be doing both. So I can listen. And then when I'm like, wow, that's really an interesting passage, I want to go back and I want to look at it in the text. Let's talk a little bit about pulp fiction that you've worked to promote and preserve the legacy of pulp fiction through various anthologies and projects. So first, you know, what is the definition of pulp fiction, and why do you think it's important to keep this history alive?
Well, a lot of wonderful writers wrote for pulp magazines. You know, pulp magazines were named for the paper on which they were printed, which was cheap wood pulp, the cheapest paper you could get. And in the late teens, certainly the 20s and 30s, money was scarce for readers, and you could buy a pulp magazine for a dime or 15 cents, and the publishers paid very little. It was famously known as the penny ord kind of publishing empire, but a lot of writers, a lot of really great writers, would get their starts there. Raymond Chandler wrote for the pulps long before he had books out. So did Dashiell Hammett. So did John D. MacDonald. So did Mickey Spillane and Ed McBain. A lot of wonderful writers, and writers somewhat less known, who you may not know, but who wrote very good things for the pulps. So I like to keep it alive. It's not my absolute favorite kind of fiction. They got paid a penny a word, and as a result, it was not uncommon for you to read a paragraph where somebody would say, you know, I got in the car and I drove to this place, right door. I got into the car. I turned the key and started the car. I drove down Santa Monica Boulevard for about 2 miles and made a right hand turn. And then they finally get to their place. Well, they've just added 47 words that they got another penny a word for. So some of them are overwritten in that sense. But nonetheless, they really had a lot of energy, and the lesser writers, even if they weren't great stylists, really could tell a story that just, you know, Burry just went crazy along, rushing along, and they were fun.
We got a
while.
We got a super chat here from Mark Goodkin. Thank you, Mark. He says, I like Otto. Good interview. Now, that guy is not Pulp Fiction. He's not getting paid by the word, but we appreciate you.
Well, thank you, Mark.
All right. Well, we kind of got kind of at the top. I feel like I could continue to talk to you for hours, but I know it's getting late there in New York. So now that we're at the top of the interview, anything that we haven't covered that you want to convey to our audience today?
Well, we could talk for 6 hours. I could give you, how about this? I'll give you the name of a few people that write wonderful books who you may not have heard of.
That's a treat. I love it.
Okay. And this is coming from the heart. If you like hard-boiled fiction, if you're a Hammett, a Chandler fan, read James Crumley. His best book for my taste is, listen to this title. Is this a great title? The Last Good Kiss. Wonderful, wonderful hard-boiled writer. If you like novels that can pull at your heartstrings and make you care about every character and you don't mind embarrassing yourself in public by weeping, read Thomas H. Cook, Breakheart Hill, or The Chatham School Affair, or Red Leaves, about a boy who's accused of murder and his family doesn't believe him and tears the family apart. Oh my God, it's just wonderful in its way, you know. So you could try that. Tom Meade, if you like locked room mysteries, impossible crimes, pure detection in the Agatha Christie school, John Dixon Carr school, Tom Meade writes about a retired stage magician who is called in by Scotland Yard. They're set in England in the 1930s. They're new. They're coming out now as we speak. So when the police are totally baffled, they call in this retired stage magician who's now helps Scotland Yard as an amateur detective solving these impossible crimes. I love impossible crimes, I have to say. So I'm a great fan of those.
These are great tips. I've written them all down, so I'm going to reward myself with some of these on my future flights. And so we really appreciate you, Otto. Obviously, our audience loved this interview, loved hearing from you, and we appreciate all of the gifts that you've given us. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank all of you people who wrote something nice, because I can actually see the chats here. They're a little hard for me to read, but I can see a lot of the comments that you made, and you've been very generous to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And of course, yes, thanks all of you who joined us today. Of course, don't forget, the Atlas Society is a nonprofit. Our main mission is engaging young people with the ideas of Ayn Rand. So whether it's a super chat on this or heading over to www.atlassociety.org/donate, leave a little something in the tip jar to make our work possible. And make sure to join us next week for a pre-recorded interview with Madison Campbell of Leda Health. You can learn more about her on her website and find our email for sending in your questions in advance. So we'll see you next time.